Hi everyone, Henry here. Two announcements before we get started. First, Brandon and I recorded in a new space, which was a little echoey, so please bear with us. Secondly, we would like to issue a trigger warning. In this episode, we will be discussing the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh and a couple other instances of hate crimes towards the Jewish people. Thank you, and please enjoy our finale to Ragman.
Hello, and welcome to Funny, They Don't Look Jewish, where Judaism appears in the panels. Our purpose, as always, is to find characters, stories, and issues of comics that explore explicitly Jewish content. I'm Brandon Bernstein.
And I'm Henry Bernstein.
No relation. Henry, I'm not going to lie, this feels a little weird.
It's really weird. We haven't done this in a while.
I'm like kind of flexing old muscles that I haven't used in a bit, and we're in a different space than usual.
We're in a different space, and we're in a different year. It's now 5780. We're in the future.
Oh my goodness, our past selves did not know what was going on at all. The things we could tell them.
So Shana Tova, everyone. Chag Sameach, Happy New Year. Our last episode was a little bonus episode where we looked at appearances of Ragman in the show Arrow, and I hope you listen to it and enjoy it. We're going to continue our exploration of Ragman, Rory Regan, with our part two right now, looking at a few other issues. Brandon, what are we looking at today?
Well, we're diving forward a little later in the 90s now and seeing where Ragman goes. So Ragman appearances, as far as we can tell, especially when it comes to Jewish content, are kind of few and far between, but we're going to be looking at a two-parter in Batman number 551 and 552. Then we're going to be looking at a Ragman one-shot special from the 2000s, followed finally by an issue of a series called Shadow Pact. But why don't we go ahead and dive in on those Batman issues, starting with Batman number 551, published in 1998. This issue is titled Suit of Evil Souls. It's written by Doug Munch, drawn by Kelly Jones, inked by John Beatty, colored by Gregory Wright and Android Images, lettered by Todd Klein, and edited by Dennis O'Neill and Jordan B. Gorfinkel.
This is a classic Batman team. Doug mentioned Kelly Jones and Denny O'Neill and Gorfinkel. They really took Batman through the 90s. They're like one of the teams that, especially mentioned Jones. The way in which Jones draws Batman, it's very uncomfortable. It's like he's massive and everyone's sort of stretched out and a little funky, but it works for Batman. Jones definitely has a horror vibe to Batman. Like, this is a scary being. If you saw Batman in the street, you'd run for your life.
Yeah, criminals are a cowardly and superstitious lot.
There you go. And one of the things that Jones does is draw Batman's ears, often mistaken as horns, but they are ears, as very, very tall. And, you know, it's sort of like, well, how does Batman fit through a doorway? But, you know.
Because comics. The one thing I do want to say really quick, Doug, I thought it was Munch, but I guess Mensch.
I always read it as Mensch because...
Because you wanted him to be a Mensch?
Anyway. But it could be Munch. I don't know. Apologies to Doug, Munch, Mensch. We're in our, you know, the same thing we did with Carl Kessel Kiesel, but yeah. What are you going
to
do?
Doug is explicitly not a Jewish author. Hopefully we're going to get to this one day in the podcast, but he started writing Jewish characters really with Moon Knight. And the only reason that he chose to make Moon Knight Jewish is because he named Moon Knight after a friend of his who was Jewish. So he decided, well, better write him as a Jewish character. We'll get into that story in a later episode. But I think what this shows us is this may be one of the first times that we're really diving into an author who really plays with a lot of explicitly Jewish themes, but is not coming from an internal Jewish understanding and worldview. And I think we're going to see how that's reflected and refracted in these issues, because it's really high in Jewish content. And spoiler alert, a lot of it just always feels a little bit off because it is clearly not coming from an actual Jewish perspective.
I agree. Let's take a look at Batman 551. And we go right to the page with the credits that Brandon described. Batman is chasing down what looks like a neo-Nazi. He's has short hair, running through he's running through an alley, has a swastika tattooed on his arm, and it says Hitler Youth. So we kind of already know what this is going to be about.
Yeah.
Batman chases him down and says, "You murdered Benjamin Mizrahi." And the neo-Nazi says, "You're crazy, get away from me." And then Batman says a sentence that rocked me to my core. "Half the congregation of Temple Beth Israel saw you." And They go through the rest of the page. Batman's interrogating him, asking him to explain the tattoo. Are you a member of a group called the Aryan Reich? And why did you murder Benjamin Mizrahi? So I just want to say something. I know we're just on the first page, first couple pages, but already I read this a few months ago when we were talking about it, read it a few weeks ago, and just coming on the coming up on the first anniversary of the Pittsburgh shooting and everything that's been happening in our world, I can't believe how real and how relevant that one little panel and that one little sentence Batman says is 20 years after it was written. And it really shook me. I had, like, you know, goosebumps, and even right now I'm, like, just thinking about that. I can't believe that, you know, that 20 years later we're talking about this in a real way.
Yeah, and I mean, we kind of skipped over it, but another part that feels to me particularly prescient, and maybe it's just a reminder that as we live our lives, we tend to think that things are new or more frightening than they were, but the reality is that there's been anti-Semitism throughout the world, and even in the U.S. for longer than we'd like to admit. Batman asks, you know, why did you hate him? And the Aryan youth's response is, he was a Jew, and Jews take over everything, even this stinking slum, which just sort of hits you with that level of hatred, that level of fear, that sort of classical anti-Semitic tactic of saying that Jews are to be hated because they have more power than we do. Obviously, it also brings to mind Charlottesville and the marching and
white Jews will not replace us.
Right, white neo-Nazis shouting, Jews will not replace us. So it's very uncomfortable. Moving over just slightly, one thing that I decided to look at, since Gotham is based on New York City, I decided to look, is there a Temple Beth Israel in New York?
There has to be.
So here's what I found. There is a modern Orthodox shul by the name of Congregation Beth Israel, West Side Jewish Center, which is located on 34th Street West, close to 9th Avenue. I'm pretty sure this is what it's modeled on. I actually looked at it, and image-wise, it looks like Kelly Jones is drawing something slightly influenced by this. It's a little different, but the double doors are very similar. It's in the city. This building's built in 1925, and also that one located right in Hell's Kitchen, so it kind of makes sense in the 90s for this to be a sort of slummy part of town in Hell's Kitchen. And then outside of the city itself, in Nassau County, Long Island, there's a conservative synagogue called, actually, Temple Beth Israel, the exact name. That building opened in 1960. So both have been around long enough, but I feel like Congregation Beth Israel was probably the inspiration for this Temple Beth Israel within the story. And the last thing I want to say about this page is just how absolutely satisfying is it to see Batman beating up a neo-Nazi?
It's great. I'm going to say more about that later, but it's great seeing Batman chase down a neo-Nazi. And then we go to a cemetery. We see Rory Regan. We don't know it's Rory yet, but he thinks Gotham again. No matter how far I wander, I'm drawn back to my only real home. Back here to the slum where I grew up. And this time, I'm drawn back by tragedy, by the loss of a friend to violence. You see what looks like a Jewish cemetery, and there's something sort of off about the gravestones. They don't look like they've been vandalized, but they look like it's been a long time since anyone cared for them. And that may just be the way Jones draws, where there's this sort of uneasy nature to it.
Yeah, I think it's more of Jones' sort of aesthetic and mood that he's got. And I think it's getting across the sort of fear that the community's feeling as you see a gathering of Jews at what we can presume is the burial of Benjamin Mizrahi.
So we go to the next page, and Rory introduces himself to the rabbi, who seems to be officiating. He says, Rabbi, I'm Rory Regan. Benjamin Mizrahi used to come to my Rags and Tatters junk shop. I was notified of his murder, but... And the rabbi said, you wish to know the details? Now, one thing, you could easily miss it in that panel that they're talking. There in the background, in silhouette, and in the foreground, is a Jewish gravestone with a Magen David that has been vandalized with a swastika. And they don't talk about that. It's just, they're just sort of setting the tone for what's been going on in Gotham.
Right.
And again, as we mentioned, Pittsburgh, this is something that's been happening in the last 2 to 3 years of grave sites in towns, happened in Boston, of grave sites being desecrated.
Right. The only thing I want to point out is, you know, you have both the sort of harrowing details of the defaced grave, and also the amazingness that in this conversation that they're having, Rory Regan, our ragman, is wearing a yarmulke, mm-hmm. right? He is at this Jewish cemetery and he's wearing a kippah, and I'm just like delighted to see that.
Yeah, he like knew to put on a kippah going into a cemetery, especially right. at a funeral. So he's talking to the rabbi, and then the rabbi introduces himself and says, I'm Isaac ben Luria, Benjamin's rabbi. It's a great name.
Amazing name. Very clearly a reference to Rabbi Isaac Luria, who is honestly one of the most significant figures in Jewish mysticism, especially when it comes to Lurianic Kabbalah. So significant was his contribution to our understanding of Kabbalah's Jewish mysticism that we named an entire system of that mysticism after him. And you will see over the next this issue and the next one, Kabbalah really plays a lot in it. So it's very intentional, I think. I think like, you know, Doug Mensch did his research in making sure that it's a very intentional allusion in the name of this rabbi as Isaac ben Luria.
Then he says, it happened on Sabbath outside the synagogue, witnessed by many. And once again, yeah, I mean, I was like struggling to get through this when I reread it yesterday because it just felt also right now.
Pittsburgh came to mind. Poe came to mind. The shooting in Halle, Germany on Yom Kippur came to mind at the Humboldt Street Synagogue. It's just like the number of times this past year that we have entered Shabbat or a Jewish holiday and come out on the other side with anxiety over, did something happen somewhere? What previously safe house of worship and gathering has become this, you know, the site of a bloodbath of devastation and murder. It's painful to read this. Like every time it sort of jumps to life in a way that's not very comfortable.
And it's frustrating because comics are supposed to be an escape. So we want to read comics as an escape. At the same time, you and I are engaged in an endeavor where we're trying to take something that's very real in our lives, Judaism, and look for it in comics. So here we're getting what we want. This is very real, and this is very Jewish, yet it's like, you know, I need to talk to my therapist after reading this, you know?
Well, I think the reality is, though, Henry, like, sometimes when I read comic books, I'm looking for pure escapism, and sometimes when I'm reading comic books, I am looking for, as you said, a reflection of my world to see art doing what art does, which is confronting the issues that happen, and somehow, in some strange way, talking about a murder that happens on Shabbat of a Jewish man at a synagogue in a comic book allows the conversation to just take on a different tenor than it would when talking about what's going on in the real world, right? Like art grappling with this, I actually think is a very commendable thing. And although it can be difficult and it can be triggering, you know, I'm actually really glad. It's amazing that a comic from 20 years ago is dealing with this, given how relevant it is, but I'm really glad that it is, that we can lean on this and say, this has been going on longer than just recently, and it's interesting to imagine a world in which, you know, what happens when you have a world full of superheroic characters and they're still dealing with the basic hates that we have. You can put the Joker behind bars, but you can't stop the synagogue shootings, unfortunately.
Yeah. They continue walking out of the cemetery. By the way, it's South Crest Cemetery. Any South Crest cemeteries in New York or anywhere else that you're aware of? So they're walking out, and he says, a hate crime committed by a member of the Aryan Reich. So that seems to be the name of our bad guy group in this episode. You know, call them neo-Nazis, call whatever they're called, the Aryan Reich, and which is a pretty scary name for a neo-Nazi gang that's taken over the streets of Gotham. So they're walking out of the cemetery and talking about this group that's taken over the streets. Then they get to the synagogue. The rabbi says that there are other people who are victims. Blacks, too, are victims. Latinos, Vietnamese, anyone who's not quote-unquote pure, not like the Aryan Reich. And then suddenly, crash! A brick comes through the window, and Rory immediately, like the good superhero he is, just bolts out of the synagogue to chase him down. And the rabbi's like, no, Rory, don't call the police. Without even trying, the suit of souls starts coming together, and it wraps up this skinhead and starts suffocating him to death on page 8. And says,
Ragman, defender of the weak and oppressed, punisher of evil, and you are evil.
And he's like, get away from me, man. Leave me alone. I did nothing to you.
I serve not myself, but those who need me.
And the ragman starts to kill the neo-Nazi. And he starts suffocating him again with the rags. And Rory is trying to stop him. He says, release him. Obey me. Let go. Let him go. And it's no use. He kills him. And his soul, it's hard to believe this guy had a soul, but his soul escapes, attaches to the ragman, and then on ragman's other arm, what looks like smoke or some sort of soul thing, are the letters Aleph Mem Tav, spelling Emmet, and the deed is done.
Going back for a second, on page 6, when they're walking through the synagogue, I just want to point out that you can see there's clearly a separate section up top, which just sort of lends credence to the fact I think this is a modern Orthodox synagogue, and I think that's an Ezrat and Shin. That's a special, you know, a removed section for the women, so men and women can sit separately.
Oh, there's a balcony.
Yeah,
okay.
There's a balcony. I might be wrong. It might just be a balcony of, you know, a synagogue in a separate seating area, but
yeah.
I think it, the way that Isaac ben Luria behaves, I get the impression this is an Orthodox shul. When the Aryan Reich member is absorbed into the suit, it says that he becomes a new shred of the ragman, forever bonded by a protective shem, which I just love that it said that, like, forever bonded by a protective name, and the name written there is truth, which is the idea that, like, God's seal is truth. And so I just appreciated the use of, like, a shem literally means name, but it's also used in a lot of both mysticism and also sort of Jewish magic and superstition, that a shem, right, a name of God, would be written on sort of like amulets, and it's like a protective means, and so you might sort of like have an amulet to contain a demon with like God's shem written on it to like contain things in there. So it's just sort of,
who is that for then? Because if it doesn't, they don't translate it, it doesn't say shem or name, it just says shem. So is that kind of thing just for someone like you or me reading? Like,
I think so, because it's a little strange, right? Like, the rabbi says the Sabbath instead of Shabbat. There are a lot of moments where he chooses to translate things, and yet here we have Shem, the word just sort of written. So, yeah, it's a nice little Easter egg. I wonder if in writing the scripts, Doug Mensch just sort of went back and forth between, do I translate this or do I show off my knowledge? And I'm glad he showed off that knowledge here. The next segment we're about to get into is, I think, I don't want to oversell it, but it is one of the most fascinating spreads of panels and pages that I've seen in a comic book from a Jewish perspective in a long, like, this is the sort of, you know, we're going to get a point where we're sometimes seeing repetitions. Okay, Jewish cemetery, this is something I've never seen in a comic book before, and I'm really excited for us to dive into it.
This is special. We're going to take you through it in a minute. I'm going to play one character, do a little radio drama. Brandon's going to play the other. So here's what's happening in Gotham City. Vesper Fairchild is the local radio talk show host that everyone listens to in Gotham. Vesper is a girlfriend of Bruce Wayne in 1998. She later gets murdered and Bruce gets framed for it, and that was the end of her. But she's sort of a fixture in the late 90s in Batman comics. There's a small part of this comic is about their relationship, which we're not going to get into because who cares. And just a little quick note, something I told Brandon the other day, that on the new Batwoman show, which obviously we're keeping a close eye on, they have Vesper's radio show sort of introducing each episode to kind of tell you what's going on in Gotham. And the voice of Vesper is Rachel Maddow, which is just a cool, funny thing. You know?
Amazing. And hopefully she'll do better on the show than being fridged.
Yeah.
For the sake of drama for a male protagonist.
I hope so. I'm going to be Vesper Fairchild, and Brandon is going to be her guest.
Vesper Fairchild, your siren of the night, interviewing hate crimes expert Dr. David Levy about the recent events in Gotham's South Slum. Now, anti-Semitism is nothing new, Dr. Levy.
Indeed not, Vesper. Jews have been persecuted throughout history, expelled and exiled from one country after another.
The diaspora?
Yes, originally from Babylon and then Egypt, right up through the horrifying Holocaust of World War II. After which it should have ended with the creation of modern Israel, but of course it didn't.
Are there not some Jews who see this as their fate, Dr. Levy?
Well, there are fatalistic individuals in every group, Vesper, but you're right. While most Jews oppose such treatment, of course, some have accepted this historic dispersion as their destiny, even as God's will.
How so?
The scriptures speak of a dispersion of divine light throughout the universe, and this has been interpreted on a human level as the purpose behind the constant wandering of the Jews, dispersing and disseminating the truth of God throughout this world.
Fascinating, Dr. Levy, but why this history of persecution?
Xenophobia, basically, since Jews have always been perceived as different.
But why?
Well, Judaism is deliberately insular. Some scholars feel that the laws governing the kosher diet, for example, were designed to prevent marriage, even socializing, with those outside the faith.
So there's xenophobia on the part of Judaism as well?
Perhaps. But Jews believe these insular customs derive from ancient traditions of following God's law.
And to a Jew, of course, it is everyone else who is different.
Which is why xenophobia never makes sense. Ask any black.
And Gotham's increasing hate crimes, recently including murder?
Are nothing new, Vesper. Such crimes stand today as they have always stood, as perhaps the greatest evil of all.
So that was our little radio drama. Hope you enjoyed it. This is pretty powerful.
I mean, it's intense. It's getting into some really interesting ideas. It's scratching the surface, and I just have so much to say about it. I really want to dive into some of what's actually been said. He talks about diaspora, which is the experience of Jews being outside the land of Israel ever since really the destruction of the Second Temple in the year 70. And he talks about that as being sort of inherently linked to persecution, which I guess that's one understanding of Jewish diaspora, that the experience of Jews in diaspora has been persecution. I mean, part of the reason that we use the word diaspora as opposed to exile, which ultimately the Hebrew word is like galus or galut, the exile from the land of Israel. The reason we call it diaspora is because we were tired of calling it exile. We wanted to have a word for it that was a little more positive and valence. So I'm not sure how I feel about this. One thing I was thinking about in this idea of we're persecuted from place to place to place, kicked out of everywhere we go, is the great 20th century historian Sal O'Baron, who taught at Columbia University, and he coined this term of something that he was often an opponent of, which is the lachrymose conception of Jewish history, right? The idea that Jewish history is nothing but a series of tragedies and persecutions kicking us out from one place to another. He sort of railed against this and was talking about the idea that in Judaism, of course, we have cultural highs and amazing moments of art and music and text and all these sorts of things. But anyway, that was sort of coming to mind as he was saying that the diaspora is the history of being persecuted from country to country. So don't know how I felt about that. He talks about the idea that it should have ended with the creation of modern Israel, which of course was the initial thought behind political Zionism. The idea was that if we're in a world where different nationalities and ethnicities have their own country, that the Jews, maybe the reason that Jews get so much persecution is because we're unlike other nations that have a nation. So if we create a modern nation state and become like the rest of the world, then anti-Semitism should go away. That was some of the thought, and regardless of what you feel about Zionism here and now, and that was the initial sort of thought, and clearly Dr. Levy is voicing that they thought with the end of it, with Israel and diaspora coming to an end, and Israel, Jews returning to the land of Israel, that there would be an end to it, but that clearly isn't the case. So then, now we're about to get into that Luriana Kabbalah, where I want to reread the text that our doctor says, the scriptures speak of, quote, a dispersion of divine light throughout the universe, and this has been interpreted on a human level as the purpose behind the constant wandering of the Jews, dispersing and disseminating the truth of God throughout the world. This is definitely a possible reading of Luriana Kabbalah, as I mentioned earlier, Rabbi Isaac Luria, located in the town of Sfat in northern Israel in the 16th century. Rabbi Isaac Luria had this sort of circle of followers around him and created a understanding of Judaism that really featured the idea that God initially was all that existed in the world. And when God created the universe, God had to sort of contract on God's self, a process known as Tzitzum, and then to create the world basically made light, and this light was contained in these vessels, and that the godly light in these vessels was a little too strong and too powerful, and the vessels shattered, and the light fell, and those vessels that once contained it and now are shattered, and therefore, like any shattered thing, are sharp and painful. Those became known as clipotes, and that essentially creates evil in the world. And so the reason that we have the Torah, and the reason that we have mitzvot, and we have these obligations to do, is that every time we perform a mitzvah, we are finding some of these vessels, and we are lifting them up, and we are repairing them, and we're returning the divine light to the world it was supposed to be. In other words, God had this sort of paradise-like Edenic vision of life on earth, and God's energy was just too powerful and things shattered, and so if we perform enough mitzvot, if we do enough good things, we'll make that paradise sort of world. And so what Doug Munch or Dr. Levy is doing is reading it in a way where not only is the performance of mitzvot something that makes a better world, but that arguably the reason that Jews have to continue to travel throughout the entire world is to be able to find those vessels everywhere. I actually did some looking and found there's a Holocaust survivor by the name of Carl Friedman, who in 1993, she wrote a novel called The Shovel and the Loom, and in it she has a character named Chaya who studies Luria, and she writes Chaya's understanding of Luria as follows, quote, "With the dispersion of the divine light began the diaspora of the Jews, whose task it was to gather the stray sparks and in that way restore the cosmos to its former perfection. Under the influence of Luria, the diaspora became a positive force, the condition for, as well as the introduction to, Olam Haba, the world to come. The person of the Messiah became less important. The crucial thing was to prepare the way." I imagine that somehow or another, Doug got his hands on this book and read this, because I don't know if just studying Luria on a Kabbalah, you'd walk away being like, yep, that's why we go through diaspora. Maybe I'm wrong, but I definitely that reading is possible, and I think that's what's going on.
Moving on, Rory and the rabbi are talking, and Rory reveals his secret identity, that he's the ragman. Before that, though, he gives the history of the golem. And on page 15, he goes through the history of the golem, starting with 16th century Prague, Rabbi Lowe, who we've talked about in past episodes. And the drawing on page 15 of the golem is the most 90s golem.
This is a late 90s golem as opposed to the early 90s.
Yes, thank you. Right? Thank you. So the early 90s golem was Terminator, and this is the late 90s golem who was like Doomsday slash Bane slash Clayface. He's just like this muscular, phallic, white.
Yeah, he like looks to me like Morph from the X-Men comic books, or I can't quite put my finger on it, but yeah,
he's like if you shaved down Doomsday's bones, and like, he didn't have any genitalia, and he was naked and white, it would be that.
Yeah. One thing I do want to get into, not just looking at him, but next to that, we've got a text where Rory says that the golem literally means body without soul. A couple things I want to say. Number one, obviously this is just the hazards of exposition in a comic book. The rabbi doesn't need Rory to tell him the history of the golem or what golem means. And also,
especially if his name is Isaac Ben Luria.
Golem does not literally mean body without soul. I mean, I guess that's an interpretation, but golem is essentially inchoate form. It's mass without animating force. It's like a lump of something that doesn't have actual shape, or maybe doesn't have like that animating thing. So I guess one way of interpreting that would be a body without soul, but the idea is golem literally means like shaped thing that, isn't human, I suppose.
So he could have just said golem meaning, or golem figuratively meaning. He didn't need to say literally,
right,
which is actually incorrect. It's the opposite of literal.
Yeah.
So he gives the history of the golem in connection with the ragman, which we talked about in the last episode, and the living costume that are the rags. And
it actually just starts what I'm finding to be a frustrating thing with reappearances of the ragman, which is that a lot of time is spent just recapping the 1991 series that we read. Like, none of these pages, all these pages do is basically give you that miniseries in miniature.
We're looking at Batman number 552 from 1998, titled The Greatest Evil. Credits are all the same. So we get into The Greatest Evil. So while Rory and Batman are running through the streets, he asks him who Rabbi Luria is. We get a little bit of exposition. And Rabbi Luria is being held at gunpoint by the neo-Nazi. He's describing all this pure stuff and about how Jews are evil and aren't pure, and we see the face of Hitler sort of facing the neo-Nazi. But America's changed, Jew, and now you're, and he's about to shoot him, and Batman bursts through, get down, battering.
Right, actually, just going back for a sec, I mean, yep. Talking about those words that have haunting resonance in our day and age now, what he's saying right before that is basically he's accusing the rabbi of saying that the Jews cheated and tricked America into joining the wrong side in World War II, that basically America, being a country of pure white people, should have joined Hitler and the Nazis, and the Jews are the ones that tricked them, but America's changed, Jew, right? And that, to me, was terrifying, because I read that, and all I could think of was alt-right extremists, and they would probably look at this and be like, this guy knows what he's talking about, and it's terrifying to think that this minority voice, I don't know if this is an example of the wonders of the internet allow us to hear more voices, and so we're hearing more people talking like this, or if there are actually more people believing this, but it's very scary. I do think there's a lot of people who do feel that you know, America's changed and it's not a place for Jews anymore.
And that's what's so frustrating, because the Nazis were America's enemy in World War II. Like, that's why I don't get the... I sort of understand hating a group that's other than you. Like, okay, neo-Nazis, alt-right, whatever. Nazis,
right.
Hate the Jews. Fine. But I don't understand the conflation with wanting to be like Hitler. Like, the Nazis, they were, like, these are people whose grandfathers were World War II veterans. So why would you want to then be like that? I've never gotten that part, and it infuriates me.
Yeah.
And upsets me.
Terrifying. Yeah, I don't get it either.
Well, at least in the fiction world, Batman nabs the guy, and the rags get him right away. And here's just a little cool little Jewish thing. While Batman's saying, he's being smothered, Regan, and the rags are still too strong. Rory, trying to pull the rags off, says, fire, Rabbi, a candle from the menorah, something. Meaning, get the fire to burn the rags off, because we saw that worked before. And it's nice, like, use what's around you.
Oh, this annoyed the hell.
Oh, you didn't like it?
I was like, come on, do not. Yes, every rabbi has a menorah lit in their office. Like, it's like, I guess maybe it's the heat of the battle, but I was very frustrated.
I don't think he was saying that it was lit. He was just saying, like, get something where we can produce fire. And of course there's a menorah, or probably multiple ones, in the synagogue. And probably just in the way that Judaica is displayed on a rabbi's desk, there might even be a menorah right there with candles in it.
There might be. It struck me as, like, this to me struck me as a cheap sort of, like, come on.
Our second disagreement.
Yeah, it's fine.
So, the Batman...
Right, because the rabbi's answer is, like, what I'm thinking. None here in my study, Rory Regan, not even matches. Like, why would you think there's a lit menorah here? Like, I don't know. It's just like, of course I'm not a stereotype that has a lit menorah in my office every day, like, having everything you'd imagine. Like, that's the thing with frustrates. Maybe it's because I'm a rabbi. I'm like, don't sit there and think that the rabbi's just going to sit there and, like, oh, I know menorah because it's a common Jewish concept. You must have those around you all the time. Like, no.
That's a good point. All right, I'll use your catchphrase. Fair. Okay.
Yeah, but the rabbi very quickly thinks and says, but maybe instead of fire, there's glass. And he says, it is said that the sound of smashing glass chases away demons and evil spirits. And we see Batman break the windows with his batarang, and it works. The rags suddenly let go of the young man and escape. And I just thought that was the coolest thing. It is definitely based in Jewish tradition. First of all, it's just an ancient folklore tradition that noise scares away demons. But we have it in a Jewish wedding. One of the reasons that you stomp on the glass is to scare away any evil forces. In the Talmud, in a few different places, Rosh Hashanah 16b, there's an explanation that one of the reasons we blow the shofar is to try and confuse Satan and keep Satan confused and thrown off by the noise. And in Chulin 105b, Rav Ashi actually explicitly uses a shofar on the blast of the horns to excommunicate a demon. So there is Jewish textual tradition saying that loud noise and smashing glasses and all these things pushes and scares demons away. So the fact that that's in here made me so happy.
That's awesome. Is there in Christian like exorcism and stuff like that? Is that a thing too?
Based on every movie about exorcism that I've ever seen, they usually just use a crucifix and verses. And I haven't seen loud noises as being okay. something effective.
Other than the priest yelling, like, the power of Christ compels you.
But I think that's more about the words he's saying yeah. than the volume of what he's saying.
Right. That's cool. So Rory is now, we get into some personal Rory stuff. He wants the rabbi's help, and it seems like he's going through some stuff about his own soul. The rabbi says on page 10, "You must use the power of evil to do good. Do not let evil use you." He gives him some more advice. And then at the bottom of 10, there is a lit menorah, Brandon.
But not in the rabbi's office.
Okay. It looks like they're in the sanctuary.
Yeah.
And he says, "Love of God and love for the victims, not hate for the transgressor. It is hate, your hate, Rory Regan, on which the evil feeds." "But how can I not hate evil?" Rory says. And the rabbi says, "By loving God more."
Right, and there's a lot I want to say about this, but the first thing I want to say is that could also be an electric menorah. You don't actually know, right? Like, I've been to plenty of places. It looks like a menorah, but it's not actually. Anyway, this concept of you must use the power of evil to do good, all it made me think of is this concept in Judaism that even your evil inclination, even Yetzer Hara, that evil inclination, can be controlled and utilized in holy service, right? And also there's this very famous midrash, also in the Talmud, in Yoma 69b, where the rabbis capture the evil inclination to get rid of it, because like, oh, we don't want to have evil anymore. And then they end up in a world where, like, nobody has a sex drive, not even the animals, which let's keep aside and not dive into the conversation of the rabbis' ambivalence towards sex and how they viewed it as being natural or not, or good or bad. But the idea is that anything, any evil inclination, at the root of it, ultimately, there is some sort of goodness, and that you can kind of make your evil instincts or your evil inclinations work for, ultimately, the better and the good. That felt a very Jewish thing. I'm glad the rabbi brought that up. The part that I don't know how I feel about is, you know, this idea of, like, Rory asks, how can I not hate evil? And the answer of the rabbi is by loving God more. And yet there's so much biblical evidence, right? Like, Proverbs 8:13 gets Yirat Adonai Sinatra. To fear God is to hate evil. Psalm 97:10, which we sing every Friday night as part of Kabbalat Shabbat, has it even more strongly. Ohavei Adonai Sinu Ra. You who love God, hate evil. There's actually this Jewish idea that loving God is hating evil. So this felt to me like a bit of a more Christian understanding of a Jewish concept being written in here.
On page 11, Batman confronts the neo-Nazi in the streets and starts interrogating him. He is protecting him from the rags, but also for it seems the purpose of getting information about the rest of the Aryan Reich. Okay, so two things I want to say about this. Number one, it's a very typical Batman thing to do, to sort of try to get, you know, let's just not put a Band-Aid on this thing, or get the one criminal, like, I want to know who the boss is, and shut down the whole thing. Fine. Here's what pissed me off about this. Now Batman is having a nice conversation with someone to get information out of them. I mean, if it was Mr. Freeze who was just trying to, you know, keep his wife alive, he'd be beating him to a bloody pulp. But this neo-Nazi in the streets who murdered a Jew and threw a brick through a synagogue, Batman's like, so who's the rest of the Aryan Reich? It just annoyed me. Like, I wanted to see, if I'm going to get some gratuitous violence in this comic, I wanted to see Batman beating the crap out of some Nazis. Right. That's all.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I fully hear you, and on the other hand, I think it's just that Doug Munch's point in this entire story arc, he's clearly pushing sort of this idea. Look, the funny thing is, you know, in 90s sitcoms, right, there would always be like the very special episode where things got overly dramatic because yeah. they were talking about how serious something was. And I feel like there's a sort of element where you can't quite have your cake and eat it too, that sometimes when comic books address very real social ills, they can't just treat it the way they would any other superheroic fantasy, right? In the recent run of Thor that Jason Aaron wrote, where Jane Foster is Thor and she also has cancer, right? He was very explicit that becoming a superhero can't just cure her cancer, because that's not how it works, right? He wanted to sort of acknowledged the realities of cancer and felt it would be almost disgraceful or offensive to people who are struggling with cancer and who have died from cancer to write a story where becoming a superhero just lets you get a cure. I think there's something to that element here where it's like, if he's really preaching a message of the way you fight hate, because clearly Doug Munch is the one who believes that, like, the way you fight hate is by having love for these people, I don't think the story is as effective if Batman's beating the crap out of these neo-Nazis, unfortunately. And I think it's like there's something different. You know, it can't all be Tarantino escapist fantasy where the Inglourious Bastards are going in and, like, in ultra-violent ways destroying the Nazis. I think part of what he's showing is, like, it's fine for Batman to beat the crap out of Mr. Freeze and these other fictional characters, but ultimately, this is a real societal ill. We can't just draw Batman bashing their heads against a wall.
I guess. I know intellectually you're right, and I agree with you, but I don't have any love for these guys on this page. So they... Then there's this explanation of some Kabbalistic stuff.
Yeah, we're going to move from the stuff that bothered you to the stuff that bothered me.
So, Brandon, in the interest of not going back and forth, why don't you take us through page 12 and interject your thoughts while you're doing that?
Great. So the rabbi is starting to teach Rory, and just a quick side note, although I'm sometimes frustrated that writers don't seem to know how to take Ragman in new directions and just repeat the old story beats, I kind of like this fact that Rory, every time he finds a new rabbi, is a disciple that's eager to learn from them. It kind of reminds me a little bit of, in your life, you might go and join different Jewish communities and learn from the different rabbis and take something from all of them. And there's something nice about that. So this rabbi, in teaching Rory, says, "The Kabbalah is received lore, Rory Regan, a philosophy based on mystical interpretation of the scriptures and charting 32 paths to wisdom." Okay, so Kabbalah literally means that which is received or the receiving, so it as received lore, like, great, good job. And he talks about the 32 paths to wisdom, which is a specific mystical concept that comes out of the fact that in Genesis 1, the initial creation story, God's name, Elohim, is mentioned 32 times. So that's the basis for the idea that there are 32 paths to wisdom. It's used in various aspects of Jewish mysticism. The rabbi continues, "It was developed in the 13th century as ecstatic contemplation of Ezekiel's vision, a chariot believed to be God's throne, and it espouses the doctrine that man himself embodies the universe and all its mysteries." Here's where I start to get frustrated at this conflation of things. Okay, 13th century, it was in 1205 that Moshe de Leon wrote the Zohar, which is the central text of Kabbalah, so I'm not surprised he said that, but again, everything about this rabbi read to me as orthodox, and in a more orthodox and traditional understanding, Kabbalah goes back to Shimon Bar Yochai and the time of the Second Temple and shortly thereafter, and so... you know, it's a very academic, once again, I feel like Doug did his academic research and it's coming through. It's a very academic perspective to say it's a 13th century idea. But the more frustrating part is ecstatic contemplation of Ezekiel's chariot is an entire different branch of Jewish mysticism. It is not Kabbalah. It is separate. That is chariot mysticism known as Yorde Merkabah. It's an entirely different format that has different values and different literature, and it's frustrating to see that conflation for me. Rabbi Luria lets us know that while it is considered heretical by some, it has found its way into the beliefs of Hasidism, whose adherents seek God through piety, humility, love, and asceticism. All accurate, all sounding like it was taken from an encyclopedia entry, but, like, great, good. Scrupulous observance of the Torah, God's revealed law as found in the Pentateuch, is the essential factor for the maintenance of the very universe. Yes, once again, this seems to be Lurianic Kabbalah, the idea that we follow the Torah because that helps to keep the universe functioning. Once again, it's exposition because he calls it the Pentateuch. But fun fact, right? Pentateuch, coming from penta, meaning five, so it's the five books of the Torah. And of course, the Hebrew word for that would be chumash. If you ever go to a synagogue and they tell you to grab your chumash, that's the book that has the five books of the Torah for Torah reading.
Excuse me, grab your chumash.
Your chumash, fine, depending on your Yiddish pronunciation or not. But chumash for our Sephardi listeners. but it's related to the Hebrew word chamesh, meaning five. So it's the same thing in both languages.
I've literally never heard anyone refer to the Tanakh, the Chumash, as the Pentateuch.
I feel like look at early Reform academic literature, and like you'll see, like it, really? It feels to me like a very.
But have you ever heard anyone say like I don't know how to pronounce that word because I've literally never heard it said out loud.
Pretty sure it's Pentateuch. Yeah. Anyway, the rabbi continues. The entire universe taken together is God, and man is made in God's image. Man is therefore a miniature embodiment of the universe. Which I'd say is like fairly accurate. I was actually reading, a friend of mine recently recommended I look at a Hasidic text that kind of got into that very idea that made me actually think of like sort of fractal concepts that we all sort of make up the larger Adam Harisho, not in a literal way, but it's like repeating patterns. And there's definitely the idea that if we are created in the image of God, and God is the entire universe, that therefore the entire universe in a way is contained within us. Rory then interprets it as, we are all star stuff, one with everything. The rabbi says, we are all part of the world soul, all part of God, who is everywhere and everyone and everything. Which again makes me think of sort of the Jewish concept of God fills absolutely everything. There's a lot of Hasidic commentaries on the idea of like God being hidden everywhere, that sort of the entire world as we know it is like a cloak or an illusion covering God, and you can find God everywhere. And this is what gets me a little bit to Rav Nachman. And Rav Nachman talks about, well, here, we'll get it actually in the next line. The rabbi says, God is the one and we are all part of the one. Seek and find God everywhere, even in evil. And evil's power will wither before God. And this reminds me, Rav Nachman has a very famous teaching in Likutei Moharan 282, in which he explains that you should try to find the Nekudah Tovah, the little good point in all people, that even the worst people has some good point, and that if you find that and look at it, in that good point, they're only good, and then that goodness almost like explodes outward and erases their wickedness. And he uses it to interpret a line in the Psalms that says, like, a little bit more time, and the wicked person, if you look on their place, they'll no longer be there, which normally is interpreted as, like, the wicked die. And he's sort of like, no, the wicked person won't be there because they won't be wicked anymore. It's very much this Jewish concept of how do you take the wickedness and actually, like, transform it. But now is when we get to the part I'm most frustrated by.
Oh God, this is so annoying.
So they come up, first of all, it's not the Torah, it is apparently a Chumash or a Pentateuch, because it's a book that looks just like a book we would find. It looks like a Catholic Bible. It's open on an amud, on a pillar in the middle of the congregation, and the two of them walk up to the book as though this book is, like, a Torah scroll is always treated like a holy object, but this is treating a book looking like a more traditional book as though it's the holiest thing in the world. And the rabbi says, let us pray, Rory Regan. Let us seek and find God. Let us give God our love. And the two of them get down on their knees with hands clasped in the most Christian version of prayer that I've ever seen. Never in my life have I seen Jews pray that way. They don't pray that way. The closest you'll ever get to down on your knees is like a full prostration at the Aleinu, which involves putting hands down, and it looks much more like Muslim prayer than it ever does any sort of Christian prayer. This is very clearly, I'm sorry, but Kelly Jones, I'm furious at you.
Yeah, this super duper annoyed me. Yeah, obviously there is a holiness. Any sacred book in Judaism, a holy book that has God's name in it, is treated with respect. You put it nicely on a shelf. Some people don't put it, you know, so you put it on a shelf with the spine out. Some people always keep it face up and closed when you're not using it. There are all sorts of like Bubba Mises for how to treat a holy book.
Right, or even the idea that if you have a pile of books, certain books have to be on top of that.
But it's never opened, emanating light, and you're praying to it. I mean, this is just ridiculous that they clasped their hands and got on their knees and bowed their head in prayer. About this rabbi has seemed orthodox. Mm-hmm. And then this kind of undid all that. It was really annoying.
Right. It's why, like, when you see this image, I sort of go back and I see what's read. And I'm like, it really sounds like, in some ways, a priest more than a rabbi.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways. So, once again, I just think that Doug Munch, our author, he did his due diligence and he did great homework on an intellectual level. And really a failure when it came to actually understanding what Judaism looks like on a day-to-day basis. It's like the anthropologist that goes in somewhere and writes all sorts of interpretations of another people without actually understanding at all what's going on. There's no human-to-human understanding of Judaism. It's all very much like outside looking in, reading scholarship.
It doesn't look like he visited Temple Beth Israel on Shabbat,
right,
or something.
Yeah, the outside of the building looks much more like a synagogue than the inside does in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what you think. At this point, it's kind of like going forward, Batman and Ragman and the rabbi all go to the warehouse where the neo-Nazis are found. A fire gets lit. Rory is tempted to kill. The rabbi reminds him, "Thou shalt not kill," and ends up getting shot by one of the neo-Nazis for his trouble.
Is he shot dead?
Yeah.
It's fatal.
Well, right, he's shot dead. There's a brief conversation where the only other part that I kind of like is as the ragman says to the dying rabbi, you know, the rags demand vengeance. The rabbi says, "Take it, but within the law. Do not kill." And, you know, it just makes me think a lot about, like, Dean or judgment being within strict bounds, that you always have to temper Dean with love and chesed, with mercy. You know, it can sound Christian, but there is definitely this Jewish concept of judgment. God's aspect of judgment always wants to overexert itself, and it takes an immense sort of concentration and a lot of love to temper it and hold it back, and that seems to be what this is talking about.
So then why is... Okay, there's another thing that annoys me. Batman is doing everything he can to drag the remaining neo-Nazis out of the fire so that they don't die. Why isn't he doing CPR, performing CPR on the rabbi or rushing him to a hospital? Or, I mean, Detective Bullock was in a few pages there. I mean, the access to the police and ambulances, like, what? Batman should let them and help the rabbi.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if Batman just sort of knew, like, that the wound was, like, this is someone who's... There's nothing... You know, maybe Batman was such a super detective that he knew the rabbi was dead and a goner and nothing could save him, and so better to save the lives that are still there. You know, in a way, this is like a... Instead of, you know... We talked earlier about fridging, where, you know, a character's girlfriend or wife is sort of killed for no other purpose than motivation. Very clearly, the rabbi dying is meant to be motivation for Rory and the ragman going forward.
Yeah, and that's annoying because he dies at the way end. And, like, we had that already with the rabbi dying on the way to Israel and the other series. It just felt unnecessary. Like, it didn't hit me in the emotional way that it should have. It was just sort of felt unnecessary. Like, they already won. He overcame the rags. He can, you know, with the rabbi's help. They didn't really need to kill the rabbi here. That was sort of unnecessary. Rory says on page 21, "I'm still in control. Retreat to your shadows, Batman." And then he says, "Thank you, Rabbi, for restoring what I had lost. Thank you for the love of God." And it's funny to read it like that because it's not like, "For the love of God." It's like he's actually took what the rabbi said and is taking heed in that. And then the issue ends with just some Batman and Vesper stuff. But these are Ragman issues. These are not Batman issues.
Yeah, they're very much Ragman issues. Here's a question, Henry.
Yep.
If we went through and translated all the English terms into Hebrew, other than the praying part, do we think this would read as more Jewish? Like, because... "Thank you for teaching me the love of God" does not feel Jewish.
No,
but if I translate to Ahavas Hashem, right, love of God, if I say, like, "Thank you for showing me true Ahavas Hashem," right, much more Jewish sense.
Yes.
And obviously it's written for a non-Jewish audience.
Yes.
I'm very curious if we went back and, like, reread it, if it would strike us as more Jewish.
I think always. I think, yeah. Maybe we should do that as a project one time with one of these things we've looked at.
Yeah, maybe another bonus episode. It's like Henry and Brandon read the comic in full Hebrew translate. Not full Hebrew, but, like, Yiddishize.
Yeah.
And I mean, like, we're both Ashkenazi Jews, so we lean towards the Yiddish because it's what we know.
Right.
I would feel a bit... I would feel like I'm not the proper person to represent Sephardi or Mizrahi Judaism, unfortunately, although...
Maybe when we get to another Marvel character, we'll do that a little later.
All right, well, let's go ahead. Our next two are much shorter because they're not full issues in the same way, Henry. So I'm going to go ahead and take the driver's seat as we head forward to December 2010 and a special one-shot that was released, Ragman, Suit of Souls, This issue is titled Inside Tattered Remnants. It was written by Christos Gage, which there's a non-Jewish name if ever I heard one. Drawn and inked by Steven Segovia, colored by David Curiel, lettered by Rob Lee, and edited by Joey Cavalieri and Chris Conroy. So on the first page, Rory visits the third rabbi that he's going to experience, this being a Rabbi Mandel. So Rory walks in, and he says to this rabbi, I had a question. I read about this guy in the 60s, a grand dragon of the Ku Klux Klan. The New York Times revealed he was actually Jewish. He killed himself because he couldn't live with people knowing. Rabbi, how does someone hate himself so much? Which, like, oh my God, what an intense start to an issue.
No, it's just the second panel.
It's just the second panel. Gets into that. And, you know, of course, this is not a made-up story. This is actually about a guy named Daniel Burroughs, who was a former member of the American Nazi Party and a recruiter for the United Klans of America, which at the time was, I think, the most violent of all the KKK groups that there were. And in a New York Times article, John McCandlish Phillips revealed that Burroughs actually had Jewish background. And literally just hours after the article came out and was published, Burroughs shot himself in the chest and head while listening to Richard Wagner. This was the definition of a man who was so full of hate that when he found out he had Jewish blood, he became, right, like arguably a self-hating Jew, although it's questionable, you know, just because he had a Jewish background, like the way he behaved, I don't know what it means to identify him as Jewish, but Rory comes in starting with this very strong question because he worries that his father was also a self-hating Jew because he grew up in a household where Judaism wasn't really present. On page 3, Rory says, I didn't even know I was Jewish until I was 16. My father gave me an Irish name after some actor he liked. What kind of father doesn't tell his son where he came from? And what I really like here is that Christos Gage is taking the ambivalence Ragman has had in past appearances and dealing with things and that internal stuff we were talking about. And he really brings it in this interesting new direction of a character who's wrestling with, why didn't my father tell me I was Jewish? We then get into a 6-page rehash of the entire 1991 miniseries. Once again, people just like to bring back, I guess the character's not that well known, so they need to bring back the story. So page 11, as Rory's telling the story that we've heard before of Ragman escaping and leaving the Warsaw Ghetto, the rabbi notes that Ragman left the day before the uprising ended and asks, why did he leave when there was still a chance more could be saved? And Rory just shouts in response, don't you think I've asked myself that? It is so, so intense. As Rory's just continuing to struggle with this. We skip forward to page 17, and Rory makes the comment that, like, oh my God, Henry, I love this line. Since I've worn this suit, my faith and my heritage have become very important to me. I wish I'd known about them earlier in my life. Like, as a rabbi working on a college campus, working with students who sometimes come to me and learn more and are like, boy, I wish I connected with my Judaism earlier in life. This just sort of, like, made my heart sink. Like, how incredible that it's a character who's a Jewish superhero, and because the 1991 miniseries made the idea that it's a Jewish legacy character, or a Jewish legacy hero, that by being Ragman, he connects more and more to his Judaism. That's amazing.
Yeah, the being the hero is what connects him. It's not his secret identity. It's all sort of one and the same and makes him even more Jewish.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we get into the crux of the matter where Rory asks, Rabbi Mandel, my father was a good man, a proud man. He wasn't ashamed of being a junk man or poor or old. So why was he ashamed of being a Jew? And, like, reading it, every time I read it, like, that line hits me. And I, you know, there is such a thing as sort of, like, an internalized, I don't know if it would be internalized anti-Semitism, internalized self-hatred. But, right, Rory is really concerned because being the ragman has brought him so much pride in being Jewish. He doesn't understand how his father, who was also once Ragman, how could he not have been proud of being Jewish? And, you know, in a way, this is sort of tapping into generational divides as past American generations kind of were like, hush, hush about the Jewish thing because we just want to make it American society. Mm-hmm. And then their children who grew up already accepted are like, I'm proud of this heritage. Why aren't we talking about it more? So I'm going to go very briefly through the narrative, which is basically the rabbi gives a really interesting suggestion of, if your suit's made of all these souls, why don't you talk to one of them who knew your father? And Rory's kind of taken aback by that. Page 19, he goes in and he ends up meeting the soul of actually a German who I believe was a Nazi that was taken in by the soul suit, Jaeger Brandt. And Jaeger Brandt reveals that the fire would have destroyed all the trapped souls. And so it was the suit that took control of Jerry and forced him to leave, much like the suit overwhelmed Rory in the Batman issues we just looked at. That Rory's father, Jerry, wanted to stay, wanted to fight, but the suit forced him to leave. But Jerry didn't know that the rags could overtake his will. So he thought that it was his decision to leave, and he thought that he must have been a coward. Which is just, you know, very powerful. And then we get into, on page 20, I can't believe, you know, this Jaeger Brandt then says this incredible series of lines. He says, he changed his name to Jerry Regan, telling himself it would be easier to find work that way. He put aside his religion, his past, telling himself it was to spare his family from anti-Semitism. But the truth is that he was ashamed, not of who he was, of what he thought he had done. He was the protector of his people, yet at the moment of their great need, he fled. Your father wasn't ashamed to call himself a Jew. He didn't feel worthy. Like, I don't know, that just hits me, sort of this idea, like this beautiful sort of reinterpretation of it, of like his father beat himself up and felt like he was a disappointment to the Jewish people.
Or like, if I left my people when they needed me the most, I don't even deserve to be a part of them.
Right. It's like self-exile.
Yeah.
Right? He sort of puts himself in the harem.
Yeah.
And kicks himself out of the Jewish people.
What do you think about the German Jaeger Brandt being the one to tell him all this in this sort of like, I mean, I know it's the soul of this guy, but in this sort of reflective way. I mean, I just kept like thinking like, why isn't a Jewish soul telling him all this? Like,
well, but keep in mind, it's only evil souls. So a Jewish soul, that would mean that it'd be an evil Jewish person.
Oh, right, because they're taken, right. Okay.
And we're going to get this a bit more in the next issue. But basically, this German Brandt starts to fade because he discovered that in telling this truth to Rory, he has found redemption and his soul is now free to move on. And on the one hand, you can kind of look at it as like, dude, this guy was a Nazi. I don't ever want to humanize him. And on the other hand, you know, the idea that people can find redemption and find tshuva feels to me a very Jewish thing, and I kind of like the idea that if you just have decades and decades of being trapped in a suit to reflect on your life, you're able to sort of recognize what the wrong is that you did. And I'd like to think that he, you know, came. I do hear stories of people, look, there are always the Nazis who go and just escape and like run away to South America and sort of try to live their lives and hide from what they did and, you know, screw that. And then you hear stories of some people who like feel genuine remorse over what they did. And it's really it's an ethical challenge, but I don't know, at least in fiction, I like the idea that there's someone who can, you know, it's not like he lives, it's not like he becomes a hero, he just like
finds some
redemption. Yeah. So it's a short and sweet story. A lot of it is a repeat of things we saw, but I thought it was an interesting meditation on this concept, which we also haven't seen before. I mean, it kind of relates to Kitty Pryde's monologue about being proud of being Jewish and standing up to an anti-Semite, but it was an interesting meditation on, a reflection on, Jewish pride and shame. Our last issue today is Shadow Pack number 8, our most recent issue, published in 2018. This issue is called Ragtime. It was written by Bill Willingham, drawn by Sean McManus, inked by Raul Fernandez, colored by Mike Atiyah, lettered by Pat Brousseau, and edited by Joey Cavalieri. So I just want to start off. So this is written by Bill Willingham, And as I think you mentioned, Henry, Willingham also is not Jewish. None of our writers are Jewish. But Bill Willingham is actually somewhat notoriously known as being definitely pro-Jewish, if not Jewish himself, because he's very much known as being, he's described himself as quote-unquote rabidly pro-Israel. Bill Willingham is most well known for a series called Fables, which basically is about the idea of what if all the different fairy tale characters that we know of all came from a land and they all get attacked and kicked out by something called the adversary, and they're all forced to go to New York, and they get a little neighborhood in New York where they live in basically exile. Right? And he has openly said that he modeled a lot of it off of Israel and the idea of a Jewish state surrounded by these overwhelming armies.
Really?
Yeah, so he's been on record about this. So very clearly, Bill Willingham, while not Jewish, and I didn't find much in a religious background to him, but I know for a fact he's not Jewish, but he is very much, Philo-Semitic, right? He very much seems to be someone who likes the Jewish people and likes the state
Judeophile.
Of Israel. Judeophile. But, you know, Israel, the state of Israel and the Jewish people are definitely not one and the same,
right.
But seems to have a lot of love, definitely for the state of Israel, seemingly for the Jewish people. Here, Ragman is part of a team known as Shadow Pact, and they've been captured. We don't really need to get into the details of the story. What matters is a few interesting things. One, on page 4, Ragman is narrating and telling his own story and talking about, you know, being a Jew, and he makes this comment, why is ours the only ethnicity where the correct term for us is also the most popular pejorative used against us?
Mm-hmm.
You know, reviews the fact that his father's name was originally Raganowicz, which is Polish, and on page 5 he says that the family, it's actually interesting, he says that Rory's grandfather changed the name from Raganowicz to Regan, to an Irish name, when he came to this country, thinking that it would help him to escape persecution, and not realizing that the Irish at the time were also not accepted. And so there's like some jokes there that the family's like, way to go, Dad. I actually thought it was a pretty clever retcon to explain why a character with a very Irish name became this Jewish hero. It was really interesting. But the real difference is, notice, it's not Jerzy Raganowicz who comes over now, right? It's Rory's grandfather. So on the one hand, this retcon clears things up, but now Rory's father cannot have been the protector of the Warsaw Ghetto because Rory's father wasn't even born yet. He was the grandfather. And of course, this is what happens when a comic's published in 2018 as opposed to 1991.
Yeah.
That difference of 27 years is enough to make it unreasonable. And so now, you know, it's going to be further and further back in Rory's lineage that we saw a ragman of his family in the Warsaw Ghetto. So once again, Rory ends up going inside his rags. He gets beaten up by a bunch of evil souls that are mad at him, although they ultimately can't do anything. And he eventually gets rescued by a guy who looks a little out of place because the guy looks like a Roman soldier and introduces himself as Marcus Liberius, which is obviously strange because there's this soul. And Marcus mentions that he died and was taken by the souls at the Siege of Masada.
Yeah.
Right? Which is way, way, way earlier than the Warsaw Ghetto, and way, way earlier, right? Everything we've known up until now, Henry, says that Ragman was created as a substitute for the Golem of Prague, which means we're talking like 16th century Prague, right? And now all of a sudden we're talking about something that happens in the year 73 or 74 CE, right? Masada was basically sort of the last stronghold of some zealots of Jerusalem fighting against the Romans. In the year 70, the temple's destroyed, and about 4 years later, they attack Masada. And when they go, of course, the legend of Masada is famous for its martyrdom, because when the Romans finally broke into the city of Masada, or when they broke into the fortress of Masada, they found that all the people there had committed mass suicide rather than let themselves be defeated by the Romans. So Marcus Liberius is one of these soldiers, and he explains that Rory thought, you know, it went back just to Prague, but actually before it was rags, there was always a weapon of Jewish defense, essentially, and that there was once a cloak, a spear, a dagger, and that this stretches back all the way to the days of Abraham. And it's like this magical Jewish weapon, which is fascinating. There's an image that I can't tell if it's meant to be Moses, perhaps, on page 14.
Yeah.
Like Moses' coat somehow, although you would think with Moses it would be the rod. Like, it'd be very cool if Moses' rod that did all of the miracles against Pharaoh and brought the plagues was actually the same weapon. Basically, what Bill Willingham has done is he's taken the Ragman and stretched it even further back. And now, Ragman goes all the way back to biblical times, the times of Abraham, and that there's always been some mystical, strange weapon that Jews used to capture the souls of their enemies, I suppose. It kind of reminds me, did you ever see Darren Aronofsky's movie Noah?
Mm-hmm.
So I only saw the very beginning of it, but in the opening, there's like a scene where Noah goes and he wears tefillin made out of snake skin. And I think the idea is that, like, the snake from the Garden of Eden, he's, like, skinned it and is making it into tefillin. It's the coolest, weirdest thing. I hear the movie's not actually great, but that scene was really interesting. Page 15, we just get to the idea that, you know, Marcus Liberius is basically explaining to Rory, you shouldn't feel bad about keeping us in here because you think that you're punishing us. You're actually saving us. Like, we deserve the worst punishment imaginable, and you are allowing us an opportunity to redeem ourselves. He basically describes it as though it's a redemption engine.
It's like a nice phantom zone.
Yeah.
It's like a phantom zone where you can actually, you're not just stuck in time, you can actually, like, do tshuva.
Right. Yeah. Yes, it is a way of doing tshuva, and I just think that's a fascinating concept. That's what we get here in our Ragman issue of Shadow Pact. So that's about it. It's very small. It's basically Bill Willingham trying to sort of free Ragman of his inner, you know, anxieties over the suit and allow him to move forward and embrace it a bit more. I really like the concept of the rag suit as a redemption engine. It's interesting, the idea that it connects back further. And I think, you know, we talked about Arrow in our bonus episode, as we said. I think that's mentioned, right, in the Arrow episode. Mm-hmm. It directly says that it goes back to the times of Abraham.
So he really says it goes back to the times of Devarim.
Yes. But that brings us to the end. That is, those are our Jewish instances of Ragman. So any final thoughts, Henry?
Yeah, I was thinking, while I was reading the previous issue, The Suit of Souls, I thought, wow, this is the most Jewish comic book I've ever read. I'm not so sure that, you know, like, that sort of in the moment, like, excited about it. I'm not so sure that upon reflection that that's the case. However, although he has flaws in the way that he is told or written, I think Ragman is, at this point now, our most Jewish character. We've sort of, like, been leveling up each time. You know, like, we thought, like, oh, the Thing, he's for sure the most Jewish character. And then, you know, kind of Kitty Pryde, yeah, she must be. And then Batwoman, like, she's, like, seems to be practicing Judaism. And then Ragman, whose entire being is hinged on basically the history of Judaism, the history of Jews being persecuted, the soul, Kabbalah, Tanakh, all these things. And he struggles outwardly with his own Judaism. I just wish we had more Ragman. Like, now I'm thirsting for, you know, I just said a minute ago, it's not like he exactly is a big part of the DC universe. I wish he was.
Right.
Like,
I would love to see Greg Rucka
writing
Ragman. And see what happens when a writer who really cares and has knowledge about Judaism takes a Jewish character. And I would love to see him grow. We've talked about this, but, you know, part of my frustration with Ragman is it feels like he's caught in the same loop and we just tell the Ragman story over and over again.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's actually a complaint that a lot of people had about a lot of Jack Kirby's New Gods characters and Fourth World characters, right? The idea that basically Jack Kirby did these amazing stories and every writer who touched him afterwards just retold other versions of those same stories.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until Tom King took Mr. Miracle and really pushed it in a bold new direction. I want a Tom King-like figure to take Ragman and to push him forward and to show us a new story where he's still Jewish and he does things, but, like, I want the same deep connection and ties to Judaism, but I don't want the same story beats. I don't want to see his origin repeated for the umpteenth time.
Right.
I don't want to see him go to a rabbi to learn with him for the third, fourth, fifth time. Like,
unless they're sitting at Stender and actually learning Talmud together. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But yeah, I would love to see a Ragman mini that pushes the character forward in both his Judaism and his heroic identity.
Here's a pitch. Those two issues of Batman, those should be a two-parter or even just a one episode of Batwoman. You already have Ragman from that they did in Arrow, so he can come back somehow and do it. It's topical. It's you have a built-in audience. You have two Jewish characters,
and then you would be able to have one character be much more of, we need to do this in a forceful way, and one that's sort of like, we need to save all lives, and we can't be right. That could be a very interesting concept. I can't even imagine what it would be like to have two Jewish superheroes responding to shootings outside of or inside of a synagogue. That is a Even with all the treasure trove of Jewish content we found, I can't imagine that actually happening.
Yeah, of course not.
But I love that idea.
But it's not a good pitch.
Yeah, great pitch.
I mean, I think Ragman might even make an interesting CW series. I mean, they're very good at taking obscurity and making it interesting. You know, I mean, it's not going to happen, obviously, but why not?
Sure. Sounds good.
Overall, I think I'm really happy we spent time on Ragman because, I mean, technically three episodes now, you know? I mean, that's more than we spent on anyone else, and it'll be curious to see who can sort of top him going forward. And, you know, 4 out of 5, my game Davids for Rory Regan Ragman for me.
Yeah, I think as you said, when it comes to, as a Jewish character, he's at the top or tied at the top, or, you know, like, he's deeply, deeply, deeply Jewish, and unfortunately, I think also has some of a real crapshoot when it comes to the quality of the stories that are written. A lot of interesting ideas, some better in execution than others, but high up there. And we'll be leaving behind Ragman, we'll be leaving behind DC. I think we're jumping back to Marvel for next time. Mm-hmm. I believe, if I'm correct, we're going to be heading over to the Moon Knight himself, who's another obscure character, but is deeply Jewish, and I'm really looking forward to diving into Moon Knight. He's been a favorite of mine for a long time.
I'm excited. I know nothing about Moon Knight other than what you've told me.
It's a real treat, but this, we've been going on for a while, so we're going to wind it to a close. It's so good to be back, everybody. Thanks for listening, and until next time, I'm Brandon Bernstein.
And I'm Henry Bernstein.
No relation.
You can follow us on Twitter at Jewish Comics Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/Jewish Comics Pod, or you can email us at jewishcomicspodcast@gmail.com.